We are continuing our study of the book of Daniel, and we are now in chapter 7, and we have divided chapter 7 into three parts because there was just so much there that we needed to deal with. It's a one-piece continuous picture of what's going on, and so we needed to kind of keep it tied together, but we needed to deal with it in parts. And so it's basically dealing with the dream that Daniel is having in this chapter. And he had a dream of four beasts that were coming out of the sea. And we had noted that before, and we've also recognized that this chapter provides the most comprehensive and detailed prophecy of future events to be found anywhere in the Old Testament. That should tell you that it's important, that it has great significance for what is going to be communicated later in Scripture. Remember, we talk about the progress of Revelation, and so this was the sort of the outline of those things that are to come in a concise form that's going to be then expanded on later in the book of Daniel and then later in other prophetic works of the Old Testament and further in the New Testament and culminating with what is in the book of Revelation. And we have also recognized that the book of Daniel and the book of Revelation overlap greatly in many ways that we will look at a little bit more in a couple of minutes. So we were basically just introduced to the four unique beasts that are noted here, and we recognize that these beasts image some particular realities. And then there was the fourth beast that had the ten horns, and another horn was mentioned, and those are going to be expanded on as well. But let me give you a quick overview of or review of the first part of the chapter because it's really kind of all tied together. So there's a description of Daniel's dream of the four great beasts. And so this dream is identified by its main characters, which predominantly is these beasts initially. And this chapter is the hinge of the book of Daniel. We've recognized this previously as well. Chapter 1 of the book of Daniel is basically an introduction. It introduces you to the characters, including Daniel and his three friends, and that they had a special place, and God was working in a special way with them. And then chapters 2 through 6 are giving various accounts, and they are written predominantly in Aramaic, as is this chapter, chapter 7, and they deal with the dreams of Nebuchadnezzar and also the handwriting on the wall for Belshazzar as well. So then the later part, the latter part of the book of Daniel, chapters 8 through 12, deal with the things that are introduced in chapter 7 but are expanded on. So that's why this is the hinge. It connects with the previous, and then it deals with what's coming after. So it's a very important particular passage or chapter. The timing and nature of the revelation are significant. Again, we had pointed out that this is the beginning of the times of the Gentiles. It's starting off with Nebuchadnezzar, and it goes until the return of Christ to establish his kingdom. And so there's a lot of history that is tied up here. And it was initially brought up in the dream that Nebuchadnezzar had in chapter 2. And now this chapter, chapter 7, there's a lot of parallels because they're dealing with the same basic history but presented in a different form. And this is then going to be expanded on. Then this dream particularly references beasts and horns. And so we want to think about what those. This is verses 9 through 14. The first beast is like a lion. It imaged the Babylonian Empire. The second beast, like a bear, imaged the Medo-Persian Empire. The third beast, like a leopard, imaged the Grecian Empire. And the fourth beast, like a vicious beast. It's not as descriptive because there probably wasn't a particular beast that fit. It's kind of giving us a hint that this fourth beast is different, and that text is going to tell us that. But it imaged the Roman Empire. But there's something about this fourth beast and the Roman Empire that needs further identification and clarification. And then this particular beast, this fourth beast, is identified as having 10 horns, and these are in dealing with future contemporaneous leaders that are going to be coming. And the little horn is identified as, in addition to these 10, it's going to displace 3 of the horns, and it's going to be pompous and blasphemous, etc. And so this part of the dream, with the assumed interpretation that we've just pointed out here, has implications that relate to four kingdoms, as we're pointing out. Then, again, we, in the same dream, the scene changes from the land where the beasts are coming out of the sea onto the land, on the earth, and now there's a movement in the scene to heaven. So there's a description of the throne scene and an everlasting kingdom. So there's another kingdom that's going to come, that's going to displace everything that has come before. So there's a major scene change that indicates a judgment context, and it's going to deal with all of these kingdoms, particularly the Roman era empire and the empire that's going to really flow from that, that's going to be somehow related to it, but yet distinct in some ways from it, but associated with it. Now, if you're following that, you're doing well. But we have to kind of keep that in mind as we look at some of these details. So there's an otherworldly throne room that's introduced, and there's reference to the Ancient of Days, which is relating to the throne of God and a place of judgment that is anticipated. So the purpose of this presentation seems to be judgment. That's the image that's given here. Then the scene changes again with that picture of a judgment area, and then it's going to relate to what had just been previously introduced, and it comes back down to earth with the implications from the judgment that's going on in heaven and is going to relate to fourth beast in particular. The fourth beast is slain and destroyed, talking about the kingdom, the king and the kingdom, and then the rest of the beasts lose their dominion as well. So all of this is saying there's going to be another kingdom that's going to displace these previous ones. This scene change includes a main character and kingdom. The scene shifts again to heavenly happenings with significant earthly implications. There's judgments that are being made up in heaven that relate to what's going down going on the earth. And now the Son of Man is going to become the prominent person in the vision. And we would recognize, from our vantage point, being able to look back through history and the progress of Revelation, we can see that this is looking at the Messiah, the Messiah's reign and kingdom that is yet to come. So far in this text, up through verse 14, it's just dealing with a description of the dream itself. And as we have made the associations with the particular beasts here, we're doing so from the vantage point of having all of history and Scripture to be able to give some identification. But this hasn't really looked at the interpretation yet. That's coming in the section that we're dealing with today, and that begins with verse 15. So this now is the interpretation of the great beasts and the great kingdom. So we have those beasts that are dealing with the kingdoms that are on the earth, that are the beginning of the times of the Gentiles, and this is going to be a significant period of time, and it's dealing with from Nebuchadnezzar and Babylon, through Medo-Persia, through Greece, through Rome, and then we understand, looking at Roman history, that it terminated, you know, roughly around 500 AD, and therefore we would say, well, it's done. How is that going to come back? So is it coming back because of some connection with those same nations that were part of that, which is a possibility, or is it in some likeness of a similar form of government or whatever? But whatever it is, there's some identification that continues, and out of that then continuing kingdom is going to be the growth of the Antichrist or the little horn, and then there's going to be a termination of that that's going to come when Christ returns. So I'm, again, looking at the big picture, stepping back, and trying to help keep our view so we don't get lost in the details, but keep the broader picture. So now we want to look at the text as we see it here in verses 15 through 18, where we read, "I, Daniel, was grieved in my spirit within my body, and the visions of my head troubled me." Now, interesting terminology here, was grieved in my spirit within my body. So what he's saying there seems to be, because he's referencing in my body, he's saying this was a real physically tangible kind of thing. It wasn't just floating around in my head. There was something more to this because I was there in person. So this is a real thing. And the visions of my head, that's what I was recognizing, troubled me. He had some concern about it. What is going to be that concern? We'll have to look at that. Then verse 16, "I came near one of those who stood by." We have to surmise who that might have been because it doesn't tell us in the text. Based on what happens in the later chapters, there's an angel, Gabriel, usually, that is the interpreting angel. We assume that's probably what we're dealing with here. And asked him the truth of all this. What is this all about? I can see these images that are communicated here, but what does it mean? So he told me and made known to me the interpretation of these things. And so then we have the key phrase in verse 17, "Those great beasts which are four kings which arise out of the earth." So they're particular individuals who arise, who are noted, who are associated with the kingdoms. And later on, in another verse, there will be the distinction of that this relates to kingdoms. And sometimes the emphasis is more on the king, sometimes more on the kingdom, but you can't have a king without a kingdom. So that's kind of crucial here. "And they arise out of the earth," which has the idea of among the sea of people, these individuals arise. Then verse 18, "But the saints of the Most High shall receive the kingdom and possess the kingdom forever, even forever and ever." And so it's interesting here, the emphasis is on the saints of the Most High. So there's a particular people that are recognized as being the recipients of this kingdom, who are going to possess the kingdom, in addition to the one who's going to be the king of this kingdom, which is also distinguished. So there was a strong desire to know the truth of all of this. So that was his concern. He saw the imagery and wanted, okay, what does all of this mean? The vision was troubling and in need of interpretation. Now, it's interesting because in the text, the introductory chapter, chapter 1, verse 17, it says that Daniel had understanding in all visions and dreams. And now Daniel has a dream, and he doesn't have understanding of all visions and dreams because he doesn't have understanding of this one. He has some idea, but it troubles him, and it has some things that he needs some explanation on. So, in a sense, he does have all understanding because he's going to get what he needs and have it figured out, which is possibly part of the case, but the basic idea was he was a vessel through whom God communicated his revelation. But again, this was something that was that Daniel found troubling because the imagery was so potent. And I don't know about you, but if you've had a vision of the beasts that are mentioned here coming out of the sea, wouldn't you kind of wonder, what on earth is this all about? I mean, a lion with eagle wings, a leopard with multiple heads, and a bear that's doing some strange things, and then a beast that you don't even recognize, you can't even put words to it. I mean, that could be a little bit troubling. But the reference to the saints of the Most High receiving, that seems to indicate that there's a concern about how does this relate to the people of the present time. So I think that's part of what's communicated here. And so he seems to recognize that this vision, this dream, the elements of this of the visions here have implications for him and his people in some way. And that's what's troubling, because it's going to affect them. So then he's questioning the angel, which we assume is an angel. Like I said, it doesn't say specifically an angel here, but most likely is. The word angel simply means messenger anyway. And so there were parts of the vision that he did not understand, and there were some elements of it that were of particular concern to him, and that particularly related to the matter of the fourth beast and the little horn, and what was that all about? And we'd kind of like to know that too. The vision of the beast relates to four future kings. That's the crux of what's indicated here. And so the angelic interpreter gives Daniel a general answer to his question regarding the basic meaning here, and it has to do with the matter of the beasts representing kings and, as we'll see later, representing kingdoms that are associated with those kings. Verse 23 in particular is going to give us some insight on that. And so these kings arose out of the earth's population, which is what the sea symbolizes. Many passages give us that as well. So the vision of the beast relates to future kings, and then the vision of the fifth kingdom includes references to saints. So there's a reference to a fifth kingdom here that includes a relationship with the saints, with the holy ones. Exactly who are those? Some assume that it may be relating to believers of all ages. Others have concluded, well, this is a Jewish context. This is a particular place and time, and it's going to be dealing with the implications of the times of the Gentiles. And so it may be more specific, at least in some contexts of the goings on here. So there are others who conclude that this relates to the believing Jews who are alive when Christ returns. And I think in some of the context, that's probably the case. Probably not looking at believers of the church age. Why? Because the church hasn't been revealed yet. They don't even know what it is. So Daniel would not think, oh, that relates to the church age. No, he wouldn't think that because he didn't know. So if it's talking about the holy ones in Daniel's context at that time, he would likely have recognized that these saints are probably those who are believers, and that would be looking at the tribulation period from our vantage point, looking from Revelation and then looking back, we can see that. And so they will receive this fifth kingdom when the king of this kingdom comes, and they will possess the kingdom forever. So I think there's a particular emphasis on the tribulation saints in this particular context. But church believers will have a share in it because they are going to be resurrected, and they will be reigning with Christ, as we see in many passages like Matthew 25, 14 to 30, Luke 19, 11 to 27, 2 Timothy 2, 12, Revelation 5, 10, Revelation 26, Revelation 22, 5. Let me give you an example. Revelation 20, verse 4 says, "And I saw thrones, and they sat on them, and judgment was committed to them. Then I saw the souls of those who had been beheaded for the witness to Jesus, for their witness to Jesus and for the word of God, who had not worshipped the beast in his image and had not received his mark on their foreheads or on their hands, and they lived and reigned with Christ for 1,000 years. So this kingdom will begin with the reign of Christ in his return to earth when he sets up his kingdom, and it will continue for 1,000 years on the earth, and then it will continue in the new heavens and the new earth forever. So there is a continuity. The distinction is on the old earth, that's the millennial kingdom, and then in the new heaven and the new earth, that's the eternal state. So this scenario then would deal with the objection that some might have with regard to the millennial kingdom being designated as 1,000 years, but yet having an eternal element, and that I think would then fit because the context is going to change no longer on the earth per se, but on the new heavens and the new earth, and so that would fulfill that element. So the reason for emphasizing the participation of God's people in this final kingdom seems to be that it is a literal earthly kingdom. It's not just some spiritual domain, but it relates to a real earthly context, just as these other kingdoms are real physical kingdoms, and therefore we need to recognize it as such. Then, looking at verses 19 through 20, and then 21 to 22, "Then I wished to know the truth about the fourth beast, which was different from all the others, exceedingly dreadful, with its teeth of iron and its nails of bronze, which devoured, broke in pieces, and trampled the residue with its feet, and the 10 horns that were on its head, and the other horn which came up before which 3 fell, namely that horn which had eyes and a mouth, which spoke pompous words, whose appearance was greater than his fellows." Verses 21 and 22. "While I was watching, and the same horn was making war against the saints and prevailing against them, until the Ancient of Days came, and a judgment was made in favor of the saints of the Most High, and the time came for the saints to possess the kingdom." Now, if you didn't know what we know now in our New Testament times, this might look kind of fuzzy, and you wonder what exactly is going on here. But we have the advantage of history and of the further revelation of the New Testament. And so when we look at this, we see, oh, well, that certainly ties in with what we see coming in the future. And it's not that weird or bizarre, because that's what the rest of the scriptures are communicating. There was a strong desire to know the truth of the fourth beast. That's what's indicated here. The descriptions of the fourth beast and the little horn are repeated, but in doing so, there are some details that hadn't been mentioned before, and that is the beast had claws of bronze, which seems to be stressing its fierce nature. Now, if you just look at the Roman Empire, there was a fierceness to it, but if there is an element of a revised Roman Empire in the future that is associated with what's taking place during the tribulation period and all that's involved there with the reference to the beast and the false prophet and the Antichrist and all of that, then you can see, oh, okay, if there's a connection somehow with the Roman Empire of earlier times from our perspective and what's going to be coming in the future, it's going to be more intense, and it's And this particular beast, this fourth beast, is indicated as different from. So there seems to be a morphing, if you will, into some variation in the future from those same peoples, perhaps, out of them, and maybe also including some kind of political connection in some way. So the little horn was more prominent than the other horns, and that would account for its ability to displace three of the horns. This little horn waged war with the saints and overcame them, and which would be give the rationale for the judgment that's going to be coming upon it. Revelation 11:7 says, when they finish their testimony, the beast that ascends out of the bottomless pit will make war against them, overcome them, and kill them. There's some similar imagery that's referenced in the book of Revelation. Revelation chapter 13:7 says, it was granted to him to make war with the saints and overcome them, and authority was given to him over every tongue, tribe, and nature, which talks about the extensive nature of this. So, again, there are some parallels to recognize from in the book of Revelation that relate back to the book of Daniel. Then there was particular concern about the fate of the saints whom the little horn overpowered. This also indicates that God passed judgment in favor of the saints and against the little horn. The little horn is acting on its own as much as it has that ability to do so, but is held accountable for that, particularly as it relates to its effect on the saints. So this action confirmed the importance of the saints in God's mind. So that, I think, is also on Daniel's mind. What's going to happen with his people as he's communicating this? That's why he's a little concerned, because he sees there's going to be some real pressure that's coming in the future. So all of this seems to indicate that God is working out a plan through the kingdoms of men, and it's going to be dealing with implications for his people in the future. Then, looking at verses 23 through 24 and then 25, thus he said, the fourth beast shall be a fourth kingdom on the earth, which shall be different from all other kingdoms. And I think it's really crucial to recognize there's something different about this fourth beast that we need to recognize, and shall devour the whole earth, trample it, and break it in pieces. The ten horns are ten kings who shall arise from this kingdom, and another shall rise from them. He shall be different from the first ones and shall subdue three kings. Verse 25, he shall speak pompous words against the Most High, shall persecute the saints of the Most High, and shall intend to change times and law. Then the saints shall be given into his hand for a time, times, and half a time. Now, where have we heard that before? That sounds familiar. Oh, let's see. Book of Revelation, Book of Daniel, another place as well. So how long is a time, times, and half a time? Well, time, when we look at this text and many others, we think, well, that seems to relate to a year. Times is more than one, that's 2 years, and half a time, so you have time, times, two, one, two, that's three, and a half, that's 3.5 years, which also equals 42 months and 1,260 days. And we'll see those terms come up again and again. So there was further explanation about the fourth kingdom. There would be something particularly different about the fourth kingdom, as I've already alluded to. So the interpreting angel now gives the prophet more insight about the fourth beast, or the kingdom that's associated with the fourth beast, and particularly about the little horn, because those are some things that he was wondering about. What is this all about? So here, the dual identification of the beast with kings and kingdoms becomes quite evident. The fourth beast does not only represent a king, verse 17, but also a kingdom, as we see. And then there's the phrase talking about the whole earth. Does that mean the whole planet is going to be inundated? Well, when you look at the book of Revelation and you see the implications on things, it would seem to be so. At the very least, the Middle East is going to be implicated. That seems to be the case, like in Luke 2:1, when the whole world was to be enrolled for the tax by the Roman Empire. That was using similar terminology, but it would have related to the more immediate area around the Middle East and those things that relate to the Holy Land. Others have suggested, well, if there's a one-world government that's going on at this time, looking at, again, from the New Testament perspective, Revelation 13 and others, and there's a worldwide dictator, there would be the implication for the whole world anyway in that sense. And so this fourth kingdom is going to bring havoc on the earth, and it's going to be in a way that is different from what the other kingdoms in the past had done. So that would certainly fit with what we see in the book of Revelation regarding the tribulation period, which is going to be culminated by the return of Christ to put an end to this kingdom. A little horn will arise to prominence among 10 other horns. One difference between the description of the little horn here and earlier is that here the little horn is a king, not a kingdom. So there's a differentiation in context from time to time. Another is that he will be different from the previous 10 kings that are referenced. And then there are some New Testament references to think about that use some similar imagery. Now I'm going to read through Revelation 13, 1 through 7, and just think about the terminology that's used here, the imagery that's communicated, and the time frame that's referenced. Revelation 13, 1 to 7, if you want to check it out. Then I stood on the sand of the sea. There's reference to sea again. And I saw a beast rising out of the sea, having 7 heads and 10 horns, and on his horns 10 crowns, and on his heads a blasphemous name. Now the beast which I saw was like a leopard. His feet were like the feet of a bear, and his mouth like the mouth of a lion. Now, that's similar terminology. Does it mean it's exactly the same thing? No, but you can see there's some imagery that's used again that is communicating something about the beast. Then it says here, the dragon gave him his power, his throne, and great authority. And I saw one of his heads as if it had been mortally wounded, and his deadly wound was healed. And all the world marveled and followed the beast. So they worshiped the dragon who gave authority to the beast, and they worshiped the beast, saying, who is like the beast? Who is able to make war with him? And he was given a mouth speaking great things and blasphemies, and he was given authority to continue for 42 months. Then he opened his mouth in blasphemy against God to blaspheme his name, his tabernacle, and those who dwell in heaven. It was granted him to make war with the saints and overcome them, and authority was given him over every tribe, tongue, and nation. You see the similar imagery, terminology, time frame. That doesn't mean they're identical, but it does mean there's a relationship in some sense. Revelation 17, 12 says, the 10 horns which you saw are 10 kings who have received no kingdom as of yet. That's in Revelation 17, 12. They haven't received a kingdom as of yet, that which means it's still coming at this point. But they receive authority for 1 hour as kings with the beast. So this 11th king's boastful words will be against the Most High and against his saints, and he will wear down the saints, evidently by persecution. Other passages would correspond with that. 2 Thessalonians 2, 8, 9, Revelation 12, 13, 17. to 17, 13, 1 to 10, 16, 17. So there are many passages that deal with this. And he will also desire to make changes in times and in law. Some have suggested the times might be something to do with making a calendar change. You know, that's been attempted before during the French Revolution. There was an unsuccessful attempt to replace the Christian Gregorian calendar with a revolutionary calendar. That didn't turn out so well. And then God will allow this ruler to have his way for a time, times, and half a time, or 42 months, or 1,260 days, and they will be given into his hand. And so that suggests that the Lord is allowing this to take place at this time. And it's interesting that even some liberal interpreters concede that the period of time that's referenced here is 3.5 years. So that's not an unusual understanding. Revelation 11, verse 2 and 3 says, "But leave out the court which is outside the temple and do not measure it, for it has been given to the Gentiles, and they will tread the holy city underfoot for 42 months. And I will give power to my two witnesses, and they will prophesy 1,260 days clothed in sackcloth." Again, that's the 3.5 years. Interesting, that's referenced again. Revelation 12:6 says, "Then the woman fled into the wilderness, where she has a place prepared by God, and they should feed her there 1,260 days. Same time frame. Revelation 13:5, "And he was given a mouth speaking great things and blasphemies, and he was given authority to continue for 42 months. And there are some who take this as a period of this period of testing and judgment as sort of a metaphorical thing, without any particular real emphasis to it, usually by the amillennialists. But I think there's good reason to take it literally, because everything else has been, and there's every expectation that it will be, and that this is a particular time. And so this three and a half year period is understood to refer to the last 3.5 years before the little horn's destruction, or just before the return of Christ, or which we would understand as being associated with the Great Tribulation. This phrase is used by Jesus to describe the last 3.5 years of the 7-year tribulation, referenced in Matthew 24:21. But there's still a question that remains that we've sort of brought up already, and that's the relation of this Roman Empire to this fourth kingdom. How is that tied in? When the hordes from the north conquered the Roman Empire in the 5th century AD, they did not unite to form one empire. It sort of divided into a number of different entities. Individual nations emerged out of the Roman Empire. And some of those nations and others that came from them have continued to the present day. So this has caused some to view the present age as the ten-horned era of the beast, but most premillennialists would hold that Christ is going to be returned before the thousand-year reign, based on these texts and others. They hold that the ten horns are yet future. That seemed to be the emphasis in Revelation, the book of Revelation as well. And then that the present church age is not seen in this vision. It is a parenthesis. And everything in Scripture seems to indicate that as well. But the ten kings will be contemporaneous, will function at a particular time in the future. And they will be somehow associated with the Roman Empire of the era up until its demise. And so there's some connection there. That's not particularly clear at this point to us. I suspect it will be in time. I mean, we have our speculations, but there's another interesting observation that some have made, and that is that Jesus Christ ministered on the earth for 3.5 years? Is there some correlation there? Is there a mimicry of Satan dealing with this same length of time? Interesting thought. Something to contemplate. That would not be surprising. Then looking at verses 26 to 28, "But the court shall be seated, and they shall take away his dominion to consume and destroy it forever. Then the kingdom and dominion and the greatness of the kingdoms under the whole earth shall be given to the people, the saints of the Most High. His kingdom is an everlasting kingdom, and all dominions shall serve and obey him." This is the end of the account. "As for me, Daniel, my thoughts greatly troubled me, and my countenance changed, but I kept the matter in my heart." There's sort of a potency to this, is what he's saying. So there was further explanation about the final kingdom. This text points out the continued divine intervention on earth. What's interesting about chapter 7 in the imagery that's here is you bounce back and forth from earth to heaven, to earth to heaven, to earth. And you see God orchestrating things. And I think it's helpful to keep that in mind, that there's this heavenly court that's taking place up there that's passing judgment on the things that are going on the earth. So there's an interrelationship there. Second Thessalonians 2:8 says, "Then the lawless one will be revealed, whom the Lord will consume with the breath of his mouth and destroy with the brightness of his coming." And then there's another element of finality that's noted in Revelation 19:20, which is probably quite familiar to us. "Then the beast was captured, and with him the false prophet, who worked signs in his presence, by which he deceived those who received the mark of the beast, those who worshipped his image. Those, too, were cast alive into the lake of fire, burning with brimstone." So there's a finality to that element. That's as far as wrapping up the fifth, or wrapping up that fourth kingdom that's going to be replaced by the fifth kingdom under the Son of Man's leadership, which is going to take place in that kingdom, then will be inaugurated or initiated. So this fact, again, argues for the normative dispensational interpretation, which understands the kingdom of God on earth as beginning with Christ's second coming rather than his first coming. That's how we would normally understand that. You may recall Daniel 2:44, when we had gone through that portion. It says, "And in the days of these kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom which shall never be destroyed, and the kingdom shall not be left to other people. It shall break in pieces and consume all these kingdoms, and it shall stand forever." So again, the picture is of God's kingdom taking over, taking the place of all of these other kingdoms. But there's another emphasis here, and that is the angel again stressed the role that the saints will have in this future kingdom. It's not just about Christ returning and having a kingdom. It has implications for the saints as well, for the people of God. And you have to look at the context to determine which ones exactly are in view at which time. So these saints are recognized as the people of the Most High. It seems to indicate the saints generally in this context, because we recognize there will be not only the people who survive and enter the millennial kingdom, having gone through the tribulation period, but there will also be those resurrected saints that will be in that kingdom as well, looking at the New Testament emphasis. So the Son of Man's kingdom will be endless. It will be worldwide. It includes the rule of the Son of Man, which Christ recognized as his designation, and the Messiah. but also the rule of the saints. And, of course, the New Testament, again, communicates that rather specifically. So it's not difficult to understand or recognize that Daniel had a concern about matters relating to the kingdom. And what's interesting is in Daniel's experience, and he had a long time, like 80 years, he was a part of several of these kingdoms. And so that would have, and he was part of the beginning of the times of the Gentiles. So this would have been very prominent in his thinking. So it's not surprising to see that as the Spirit was working in him to communicate this to us as well. So, and again, this kingdom emphasis that we see here aligns with the New Testament revelation of the millennial kingdom. I mean, it fits like a hand in a glove. They just communicate the same basic idea. And so it fits with the second coming emphasis of the ultimate rule of Christ. His kingdom is an everlasting kingdom, and all dominions shall serve and obey him, as it says in verse 27. This whole vision was so weighty that it was quite alarming. Daniel had concern about this. He indicated, okay, this is now the end of the vision, and it states that he had alarm and concern. The blood drained from his face as he contemplated the trials and the tribulations that were going to ensue in the process of wrapping up this, the implications of the fourth kingdom under the pressure from this, what we would understand as Antichrist. And so this was a rather weighty kind of matter that was taking place. So there appear to be two sets of prophecies of the future in chapter 7, in addition to those things that would be taking place during Daniel's time frame. First, there are prophecies that deal with coming world empires that appeared to Daniel as regular nations, and the real, literal, physical nations. Then there were predictions about the end of the fourth kingdom and the beginning of the fifth kingdom, which are still future events from the standpoint of history. And then there's a gap that seems to be there that we would understand would fit the time frame of the church age that would be somewhat communicated. And if you think about having read Luke chapter 4, when Jesus is talking in the synagogue and he is quoting from Isaiah 61, 1 and 2, and he gets halfway through that text, and then he says, now this is fulfilled in your hearing, and it related to his first coming, but he didn't deal with what was coming, what was going to be dealt with in his second coming. He stopped short of that, which would communicate that same basic idea. It's also interesting to think about 1 Peter chapter 1, verses 10 to 11. It says, of this salvation the prophets have inquired and searched carefully, who prophesied of the grace that would come to you, searching what or what manner of time the Spirit of Christ who was in them, was indicating when he testified beforehand the sufferings of Christ and the glories that would follow. Two aspects, the sufferings of Christ and the glories that would follow. Another distinction that is communicated here. So let me wrap it up with a summary. And I'm not sure you can see this, but if you can, this gives the basic elements of this text, verses 15 through 28. The interpretation had to do with the four beasts, the saints, the fourth beast, ten horns, little horn, all kingdoms of heaven given ultimately to the saints. There's an element there. And then the revelation ended. And I just want to sort of summarize what the premillennial understanding is coming from this passage, why this passage has significance for clarification with regard to those things that take place later on in Scripture. The first thing is that Messiah's kingdom follows the Antichrist's appearance and destruction. In Daniel, it is described in personal rather than institutional terms. The person of Antichrist has not yet appeared then or now. And this would seem to make the post-millennial or amillennial schemes identifying the church with the kingdom as unfeasible. I mean, this scheme time frame would not fit. Then the second element is the kingdom of Messiah here follows the Gentile kingdoms. The times of the Gentiles will take place first, then the millennial kingdom will be set up. At no time is the millennial kingdom contemporary with the Gentile kingdoms. Therefore, it has to still be future. They were not contemporaneous. They were successive. Number three, the kingdom of Christ succeeds a final form of Gentile dominion, which has not yet appeared. This time frame where the times of the Gentiles are really in power, that's still where we are. We have not yet come to the end of that. Therefore, it has to yet be future. The Messianic kingdom is external in aspect here. It's not an in-your-hearts kind of a thing. It's all very external and tangible, and that would throw out any church kingdom theology, kind of mixing up the church and the kingdom. And then the kingdom is, in some sense, Jewish. That would have been the only way Daniel would have understood it at the time. And the saints or the holy ones here would have the main emphasis of Israel. And it's only in the sense that the church is in Christ that they relate to a connection to that kingdom. So, again, all of this really is indicating that God is orchestrating things toward a final kingdom over which Christ will reign and the saints will reign with him. And we ought to take comfort and encouragement in this, because we really have nothing to fear, because we know where we're going to end up if we are his, if we've trusted Christ, if we are his people. And even though there can be some difficult times, we know what the ultimate end is. And so this is a very important passage to try to understand, to get a handle on, as far as giving a picture. Now, this is going to be sort of the major outline that we're going to be building on with the remainder of the book and other things that we'll be dealing with in the future. And the point is, take God at his word and take it to heart. About those matters that relate to now and those things that relate to the future.